In this weekend's episode, three segments from this past week's Washington Journal. First, James Antle, politics editor for the Washington Examiner, discusses the latest Donald Trump indictment and the potential impact on campaign 2024. Then Brian Fallon, co-founder and outgoing executive director of Demand Justice, on Supreme Court reform and the state of the progressive legal movement. Plus, Cindy Kelly, founder and president of the Atomic Heritage Foundation, on America's renewed interest in the history and legacy of the Manhattan Project, with the release of the new Oppenheimer movie. Now, a conversation with the Washington Examiner's politics editor, Jim Antle, on the latest Donald Trump indictment and potential fallout on the race for president.
What is, in your view, the difference between this federal indictment and the Mar-a-Lago, the documents case indictment?
Well, I think there are a few things. Number one, I think, you know, in the classified documents case, it's pretty clear, you know, you either have access to these documents that you're not supposed to have, or you don't. I'm sure the Trump legal defense team has some theories about presidential powers regarding classified documents that they're going to use in defense. They're possibly going to compare themselves to other people who've had classified documents and maybe were not given the same treatment. But by and large, that seems to be a fairly straightforward case. In the January 6th case, clearly there's the subtext of some sort of incitement of the attack on the Capitol, but that isn't exactly what he's been charged with doing. So sort of looking at the ways in which his efforts to contest the results of the 2020 election were on some level fraudulent or corrupt is the case that's being made against him. And I think at least initially politically, that indictment probably works to his favor, at least with the Republican primary electorate, because a lot of Republican primary voters, number one, are going to feel that views that they hold about the 2020 election are implicated in this indictment, and that on some level, holding these views is being criminalized. Number two, they're going to view it as a bit of a pile-on, and this is not a portion of the electorate. The Republicans who are particularly exercised by what happened on January 6th are already not voting for Donald Trump. They support other candidates. They support Chris Christie. They support Mike Pence. They perhaps support Ron DeSantis, but to a lesser degree. So in the immediate effect, I suspect the former president's poll numbers with Republicans will not be changed. But when you head to the general election, which at the moment is where the former president appears to be headed, this is probably not helpful. The weight of all of these indictments are probably not helpful. And then just the practicality, apart from how you feel about the merits of any of the cases, there are some practical issues with being so tied down with all of these legal fights. To what degree does that cut into your ability to wage a competitive campaign?
In 2024.
Right.
So is it in terms of what we're hearing potentially, some early ideas for the legal arguments for the president's team is there's a First Amendment case to be made. And you touched on this briefly. The idea that the president was expressing his views, and you mentioned that his supporters can relate to the idea that their views are being potentially criminalized here. Do you think that works as a legal argument in addition to the political argument that the president's obviously making on the campaign trail about
that? I think it clearly works for Republican voters as a political argument. Whether it works as a political argument with the broader general electorate, I think, remains to be seen. As a legal argument, obviously, juries, you know, you can't really predict what a jury is going to do. And what Trump would have to do in this case is raise a reasonable doubt. I mean, I think that the core argument, in addition to the free speech element, is going to be where Jack Smith is going to present this all as a corrupt arrangement. I think the Trump legal defense team is going to try to argue that there was no corrupt intent, that Trump believed he legitimately won, or that there were serious questions about the election. He was pursuing them to attempt to get at the truth. And that, as opposed to a coup, what Trump was attempting to do, this will be the argument, I'm not saying it's my argument, is that he was asking other constitutional actors, state legislatures, the vice president, members of Congress, to exercise lawful powers that he believed they possessed, and to exercise them in certain ways to get to the bottom of the election. And when they did not exercise them in the ways that he asked, he left. So that's, I think, what their argument is going to be. And obviously, the special counsel's argument is going to be that attempting to do all of this from the very beginning was a corrupt exercise.
It appears the indictment relies a great deal on the interviews and the extemporaneous notes of the former Vice President Mike Pence. He has been the one now, the one Republican candidate to come out strongly reacting against the indictment. Jim Andel, what do you think this means for his presidential aspirations?
Well, I think it's an interesting test case as to whether you can make these arguments with the Republican primary electorate. Now, I think in the former vice president's case, he really at this point has no choice. I mean, he's not polling very well. He's struggling a bit to make the debate stage for the first Republican debate, although I do expect he'll probably clear the donor threshold that's required to do that. But the fact that it's this close at this point suggests some troubles with his campaign. But, you know, he rebuffed Trump on this. He's taken the stand that he chose the Constitution over Donald Trump. That's sort of where he's leaving his case with the Republican voters. It's going to be interesting to see how that works out. I think when a problem for the former vice president, just like the former president, is that so much of the conversation about them in 2024 is going to hinge on 2020. And as Pence himself says, elections are really won about the future. When you're talking about the past, that's generally to your detriment. I think Pence would like to move on from 2020, whereas Trump does seem a bit stuck in that year, which for most people was not a pleasant year, even apart from the election. But I think it's going to be difficult because of the circumstances for Pence to escape 2020.
Jim Antle is with us. He's politics editor at the Washington Examiner. We welcome your calls and comments. Republicans, it's 202-748-8001. Democrats, 202-748-8000. And for independents and others, 202-748-8002. Your publication, The Washington Examiner, frames it, the elections, like this, at least in an article this morning: Trump indictments and Biden family investigations could define rematch election. We certainly have heard, in response to the most recent indictment, the allegations of a two-tier justice system.
Right.
What about the Biden family and Hunter Biden in particular?
Right. I mean, from House Speaker Kevin McCarthy on down, that was the immediate Republican response, was this indictment is happening just as things are heating up in the investigation of Hunter Biden. And the revelation that the current president, President Joe Biden, was at least present on the speakerphone and at some luncheons for some meetings with Hunter Biden business associates, which isn't necessarily quite the smoking gun Republicans were hoping for, but it's certainly a development beyond what we were previously told about the president's level of involvement in his son's business activities. We were told that there was pretty much a firewall. Now we're told, well, he was around, but he was talking about the weather and exchanging pleasantries. So, I think this is going to become a big part of the Republican weaponization, two-tiered system of justice argument. And whether that works with the broader electorate, I don't know, but it certainly has some resonance with the Republican primary electorate.
To your point about elections being, Mike Pence's point, elections being about the future,
right,
does this sort of back and forth between the two campaigns, the Biden campaign, the Trump campaign, provide an opening for a candidate who will talk about, not only talk, but propose about the future and break away from the arguments of what the current indictments are all about, or what the Biden family is doing, instead focusing on the issues in the campaign?
Well, I mean, I think if you look at polls, most voters do not want a rematch between Trump and Biden. That is not a popular set of choices. But if you also look at polls of Democratic and Republican primary voters at the moment, the current trajectory is to provide that rematch.
Right.
I mean, both men have pretty healthy leads over their primary opponents. President Biden doesn't really have a top-tier challenger of any kind. And Donald Trump's lead over Ron DeSantis, his closest challenger, is almost as big as President Biden's lead is over Robert Kennedy Jr. So it, one, creates an opening for some kind of centrist third party, whether that's Snow Labels or someone else. Some ambitious person may see in a Trump-Biden rematch an opportunity to sort of present themselves and maybe get some votes if they can get on the ballot in enough states. And then I think within the Republican primaries, it really does present the opening for Ron DeSantis or someone else, Tim Scott, someone else, to say that they can sort of get us beyond the past disputes. But up to this point, nobody's been able to make that case successfully enough to make headway in the polling, either nationally or in the early states.
With the current Trump 2024 campaign, it's just a couple of days after the indictment, but right. It passed as president. That has resulted in a bump in the polls right. And certainly a bump in fundraising yep. for the former president. Any early indications of that from the campaign?
I mean, what little we've seen in terms of polling, and there hasn't been much in terms of polling since the indictment has come out, but we have seen some since the superseding indictment in the classified documents case, and it has generally been stay the course or some upward movement. I mean, Trump is generally polling between 50 and 60% of the national Republican primary electorate. That's a pretty healthy lead for a non-incumbent president. Of course, he makes the argument that he is sort of a quasi-incumbent, and many Republican voters are receptive to that, which I think has been to his benefit. But, you know, that's a pretty big lead. We'll see the fundraising numbers fairly soon if Bass is predicate. I think that this will be viewed closer. This latest indictment on January 6th will be viewed by a lot of Republicans closer to the Alvin Bragg indictment than the classified documents indictment. So I do suspect there will be some rally around the flag effect to it. And it also puts the rest of the field in a somewhat awkward position because you can't be seen as siding with Jack Smith over Trump. You can't be seen as siding with the Biden Justice Department and Merrick Garland over Trump. But if you're running against Trump, and you can't capitalize on the fact that he is now under multiple indictments, what is it going to take for you to break through?
That was James Antle, politics editor for the Washington Examiner. Next, Brian Fallon of the group Demand Justice discusses Supreme Court reform and the state of the progressive legal movement.
You're wrapping up a five-year tenure as founding executive director of Demand Justice. Remind us what that organization is about, the mission and the funding.
Sure. Demand Justice was started in 2018 by myself and my friend and colleague Chris Kang. Chris had worked as the deputy White House counsel during President Obama's time in office working on judicial nominations. And we started the group with the mission of trying to galvanize the public against the capture of our federal courts by a right-wing element that was very much out of step with the country. And now we're seeing the sort of results of that capture of the courts play out in the last couple terms worth of decisions from the Supreme Court. And so we've been trying to mount campaigns to push back on the nominees that President Trump was putting forward during his time in office and trying to galvanize support among the public for trying to counterbalance the takeover that the hard right has successfully achieved at the Supreme Court level. Our funding is primarily from two sources. We have, on the one hand, a lot of institutional donors, foundation-type donors that believe in our mission. And then also we have, at this point, over 500,000 supporters online that contribute to us on an average of like $20 a contribution. So we have a mix of small-dollar donations and then larger levels of support from foundation-type donors.
I want to show a New York Times article from the launching of Demand Justice. So this is back from 2018, and the headline was this: after Garland defeat, new group hopes to draw Democrats to judicial battlefield. The idea back then, you know, that Republicans were much more animated about judicial reform. Is that still true today, 5 years later?
The pendulum has started to swing back. You know, the project that the hard right has carried out in this country in terms of capturing the courts played out over the course of many decades. And so the effort to fight back and to try to undo that damage is not going to happen overnight either. We're 5 years into this project now. But we have made a good amount of gains in the last 5 years. You know, we were started in the aftermath of what happened with Merrick Garland. You know, Mitch McConnell blocked President Obama from filling that seat. But more distressing to us was the fact that even as Mitch McConnell was doing that, the public didn't seem that upset about it. It was not a big issue in the 2016 election. Even though the fate of the Supreme Court, you know, whether it would be controlled by a majority of liberal justices or conservative justices, was literally going to be decided by that election. It got some attention during the presidential debates, but not much. And then when Neil Gorsuch was confirmed in 2017, that sort of happened with a whimper. There wasn't much of a fight mounted by Senate Democrats against that nomination in 2017. And so from that, our group was started with the goal of trying to galvanize the public to care a little bit more. And now, 5 years later, I'd like to take credit for it, but it's really external events that have happened over the last 5 years. You had the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation. You had Ruth Bader Ginsburg's untimely passing, followed by Amy Coney Barrett's confirmation. Two highly charged confirmation battles that focused the public's attention on this issue. And then in the ensuing years, you've had rulings like the overturning of Roe v. Wade that have really thrown the public for a loop. People that took that for granted, that was a settled precedent that was 50 years old. A lot of people, we were trying to tell people that that was on the line, and a lot of people didn't believe us until it actually happened. So as a result of all these events, I think you're now seeing that the issue has never been more salient, especially among Democratic voters. They tell us in polls, more so than the Republican voters, that this is a voting issue for them. That's a complete flip from 2016, when Trump won voters that said that the Supreme Court was an important issue. And you also see it in the form of the low approval rating that the court currently has. They have a historically low approval rating. And so all this is sort of dovetailing to create the Supreme Court as as highly charged a political issue on the Democratic side as it's ever been.
I want to go back to talking about the election and the impact that the Supreme Court decisions could have on the election. Break that down a little bit more granularly for us as far as where you think that's going to go, especially with the Dobbs decision. Do you think it will impact younger voters? Do you think it'll impact the women's vote?
Yeah, so we certainly saw already in the 2022 midterms evidence that the backlash to the Dobbs decision helped soften the losses that Democrats were otherwise in store for in the 2022 midterms. You know, historically, the Democratic Party takes a drubbing in the first midterm election when that party's president is in power. And Democrats held the Senate, and their losses in the House were fairly minimized to the point where Democrats have a legitimate chance to take back the House in this 2024 election. And a lot of the exit polling shows that the reason that Democrats were able to sort of keep their losses in 2022 to a minimum and outperform expectations was because especially suburban voters, women voters, were extremely upset about the Dobbs decision and completely taken aback that they actually followed through an overturning Roe. And so I think that that dynamic will persist into 2024. This is an issue that is creating a political wind at Joe Biden's back. President Biden himself is sort of reluctant to engage in this conversation. He has stopped short of directly criticizing the court. A lot of Democrats on Capitol Hill have started directing criticisms at the Supreme Court. Joe Biden has sort of stood back from directly engaging in that conversation, but the dynamic is certainly there. His team is certainly aware of it, and I think that they know that it will only benefit him, this backlash to the Supreme Court. It is seen, this court is seen as an arm of the Republican Party, that the MAGA Republican wing that Trump, that Joe Biden rather, is running against in 2024.
Your website, demandjustice.org, here is the front page of it. It says the Supreme Court is broken. We can restore balance by adding seats. How are you really going to do that? Especially Joe Biden has said he's not interested in doing that.
Yeah, so, you know, this is a generational struggle that we're in. Like I said a few moments ago, the Republicans weren't able to win over, capture the control of the Supreme Court in a matter of months or even in just a couple years. They did it over a course of many decades, and they built up strong organizations like the Federalist Society to help them carry out that mission. And so now the pendulum is starting to swing back, but it's only just starting to swing back. And this is really going to be a generational, years-long struggle that we're in. They have a 6-3 conservative supermajority on the Supreme Court. I think some people think that, you know, Democrats can just sit back passively and hope that retirements or ill-timed illnesses occur and the Democrats might organically regain a majority on the Supreme Court, realistically, we're going to have to go out and convince the country about structural reforms to the court. There's been academic studies. There was a Harvard researcher that came out with a study that said, unless some kind of legislative solution, some kind of reform is enacted, the hard right wing of the conservative Supreme Court will remain in power until 2065. That's a very sobering thought. And so a lot of us are trying to help cultivate a conversation about structural reforms that could rebalance the court sooner than that, to include ideas like term limits, like adding seats. Obviously, this is not going to happen this Congress when you have a Republican-controlled House, but we're making a lot of great strides to build support for these ideas, not just at the grassroots level with voters, but the Judiciary Act, which is a proposal that would add seats to the Supreme Court, was reintroduced this year with more co-sponsors than it's ever had.
And you mentioned the Federalist Society. We're going to start taking calls shortly, but one more question. Mm-hmm. The Federalist Society, there's also Judicial Crisis Network. What are those groups? What kind of impact do they have?
Oh, they've been highly successful.
And in doing what?
In mobilizing Republican voters to care about the courts as an issue and to vote according to the Supreme Court as an issue, to ask, to insist on their candidates speaking to the issue, to the point where Donald Trump literally released a list of names in 2016 about people that he promised to look at in terms of who he would nominate. They've succeeded in getting super donors on the Republican side to give money to this project. Leonard Leo, the head of the Federalist Society, the former head of the Federalist Society, has been particularly successful at getting large mega donors on the Republican side to give huge eight-figure gifts to the Federalist Society and affiliated groups to help fund this effort. One thing that, you know, one structural advantage that they've had is resources. The amount of giving that flows into groups like the Judicial Crisis Network and the Federalist Society dwarfs on a scale of like 6-1, 7-1, the funding that flows into groups like mine on the other side. But they've been extremely successful. And if anything, when we go to Capitol Hill and meet with Democratic lawmakers, our point to them is we need to get into the game and compete with the groups that are doing so well on the Republican side, galvanizing support for this issue.
Well, Brian, let's take a look at a Gallup poll that was asked the question about Supreme Court job approval by party. So Republicans have a 62% approval rate for the Supreme Court. Independents are at 41%. Democrats are only 17%. You know, you said before the you know, approval of the Supreme Court is at historic lows. What needs to happen to turn that around?
Well, by the way, that's a relatively recent phenomenon, because when we started polling Democrats in 2018, when we started, a majority of Democrats approved of the job that the Supreme Court was doing. And that was because Democrats had sort of a view of the Supreme Court that was somewhat rosy based on, you know, civics lessons that we learned in history from the Brown versus Board of Education type era. And then there had been recent rulings like the decision to uphold the Affordable Care Act, the decision to recognize same-sex marriage, that caused progressives to think that, by and large, the Supreme Court was doing an okay job. But like I said, the events of the last 5 years with the heated confirmation battles and then the decisions like the Dobbs one have caused Democrats and independents, only 41% of independents, they're underwater with those two key groups. And so it's not surprising that two-thirds of Republicans are supporting it, because they're getting, you know, what they voted for in terms of rulings like the Dobbs ruling. But Democrats and independents being against the court in such large numbers is not a viable situation long-term for the Supreme Court.
That was Brian Fallon, founder of the group Demand Justice. Next, a discussion about Americans' renewed interest in the history of the atomic age in the U.S. with the popularity of the new film Oppenheimer.
Cindy Kelly is with us. She is the founder and president of the Atomic Heritage Foundation. With us in this last segment of Washington Journal, we'll dive a little deeper into the man, Robert Oppenheimer, and the history of the Manhattan Project. First, I'll get to your organization first, but for the film itself, are you surprised a film about Robert Oppenheimer has this become this big box office draw in the United States?
This was my hope all along. I saw what happened with World War II history when Steven Spielberg came out with Saving Private Ryan. Before that, there was a World War II commission trying to raise money for the big monument on the Mall.
Right.
And they were getting nowhere. That film came out and galvanized the American audience. It taught them of history in a dramatic way that they hadn't heard before. And they raised that money. Not only did they raise all of the money for the monument, but money for keeping it maintained for posterity. So it was a game changer. And thousands of books came out and so forth and so on. We needed a book. We needed a movie like that for the Manhattan Project. I've been working on this for 25 years. And there have been some great books. Richard Rhodes's Making of the Atomic Bomb in 1987, and of course American Prometheus, on which the book is based, by Martin Sherwin and Kai Bird, which came out in 2005, and dozens of others, very credible, good books, but nothing that has been, no movie has been a blockbuster.
So you say you've been working on this for 25 years, which gets us to your organization, the Atomic Heritage Foundation. You're its founder and president. Why did you start it? What is its mission?
Well, I began it in 2002. I had been with the Department of Energy. In fact, I had a full career in the federal government before I began. That was unrelated, working for the Environmental Protection Agency and then cleaning up the former nuclear weapons complex. But when working for DOE, which is the successor agency to the Manhattan Project, I was appalled they were going to tear down all the remaining buildings that were put up by to work on the Manhattan Project on laboratory property. I said, aren't you going to save any? And they said, no, why should we? So I was able to get a small federal agency, the Advisory Council for Historic Preservation, to get interested. And they brought their advisory team out, and they said, these are monumental in their lack of monumentality. They were just like overgrown garages, you know, just asbestos shingled, small buildings put up just as crude as they could be for the duration of the war to build these bombs in.
And you obviously see that. If you see the film Oppenheimer, you see these seemingly temporary but huge villages and complexes created in World War II. What was, let's start at the beginning, what was what was the Manhattan Project? Why was it started?
The Manhattan Project was started in desperation. The international community of physicists, most of whom had gone to school together, basically, in Germany. Oppenheimer was a classmate of his German rival, Werner Heisenberg. They knew each other. Well, as soon as the discovery of fission, the ability to split the atom of uranium, happened in late 1938, there was a race. All the physicists in Germany, or the teams of physicists in Germany, Japan, England, France, the United States, began racing to make an atomic bomb. They knew conceptually since the 1920s this could happen. So it was a race against Hitler's Germany. Hitler invaded and started World War I on September 1st.
World War II? Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Right, in 1939. The discovery happened in late 1938, early 1939, and it was a race. Unfortunately, the United States kind of got going kind of slowly.
It was, why?
Actually, one person said it's like swimming in molasses, bureaucracy. They appointed someone who was fairly senior. That was a good thing, except that he was kind of old. This was a young man's game. The people involved and who knew about nuclear physics, high energy physics, they were all in their 20s and 30s. And so it was not the right appointment. It was this had to be done quickly, had to be done with the right people. The British were on it, and they actually benefit from a lot of refugees from Hitler's Europe that came to work in the laboratories with the British.
You mentioned that that it was a race between us, the U.S., the Allies, and the Nazis to get the bomb. There's a scene in the film where I believe it's the actor Oppenheimer says essentially that the Nazis will be slow because Hitler, and I'm paraphrasing here, believes that physics, this is a Jewish science. Was that true? Was that his view?
It was absolutely true, and it was much to our benefits. We had at least 100 Jewish refugees, top scientists, Nobel laureates, who worked on the Manhattan Project with us because they were refugees from Hitler's Germany, Austria, you know, the Nazi countries, Italy. So it's very true. His prejudice is against Jewish people, and the scientists who were on the forefront of this was much to the benefit of the Allies.
So how does Oppenheimer come into this group of scientists, and why is he chosen to lead the Manhattan Project?
Oppenheimer was a very unlikely choice. People who were advising the head of the Manhattan Project, General Leslie Groves, whom he should select, none of them had Oppenheimer on their list. First of all, he unlike many of the other possibilities, had not won a Nobel Prize. He also hadn't managed anything. Some people thought, hey, he can't manage a hamburger shop. I mean, he had graduate students and he had to run classes, but that was it. And thirdly, he had associations with people who were Communist Party members, and his wife, for example, had been a member of the Communist Party, his brother, his girlfriend. So while he wasn't himself, he had leftist sympathies, and there was grounds for suspicion.
Why did General Groves, portrayed by Matt Damon in the film, by the way, why did General Groves have this confidence in Oppenheimer? He seemed to be Groves' choice no matter what.
He was absolutely Groves' choice.
Yeah.
Groves was he was a very astute judge of people, and he knew two things. One, that he was brilliant, and he seemed to understand what it would take to make a bomb better than the other people he interviewed. And two, he was very ambitious. He hadn't won a Nobel Prize. This was his avenue to fame. And just like Groves, who had been passed over to go into the field to have action, in Europe, in the war theater, he wanted desperately to make a name for himself. So the two of them saw the means to fulfill their own ambition in each other.
The film focuses mostly on the activities at Los Alamos, New Mexico. Why was Los Alamos chosen?
Los Alamos was where it happened. That's where the Brain Trust was, I should say, that had responsibility for designing and testing the bomb and overseeing the science across the complex. They, it was 5,000 people at the end of the war, some say a little more. They thought they could do it with 100 scientists and their families, and it just was far more complex than they ever imagined. The other sites were involved in production of the ingredients of the bomb, a hugely significant role, but it wasn't the same as designing and testing the bomb. Oak Ridge, Tennessee, for example, had mammoth factories, first of a kind to produce enriched uranium. And on the West Coast, or inland, so the Japanese couldn't blast them from the shore, was Hanford along the Columbia River in eastern Washington, where they produced plutonium and built the world's first reactors.
In terms of the role of Oak Ridge in enriching uranium, the creation of those uranium pellets, a big part of the film. The fact was we had a very small capacity, like a lot of things at the beginning of the war, for doing that. So they had to ramp up that production as well in a very, very short period of time. How was that done?
Well, by trial and error. They had no idea what method was going to work to produce enriched uranium. So General Groves authorized three separate methods. Three sets of huge factories produced, one by electromagnetic separation based on a calutron designed by Lawrence in Berkeley. Anyway, that was one method. The other method was gaseous diffusion. They built a mile-long building called the K-25. The third method was developed for the Navy that was a differential in thermal in heat, and it was so inefficient. It only enriched things from 1 to 2% that they tore the factory down immediately after the war. But the three methods together, it turned out, were essential. They took it from type A and gave it to the second plant. The second plant enriched it from 2% to 20%, and then they took it to the third electromagnetic separation plant, and that put it at the level they needed for a bomb.
Of the original sites, the three original sites for the Manhattan Project, Oak Ridge, Tennessee, Hanford, Washington, the Hanford nuclear site, and Los Alamos, are any of the three still involved in the production of nuclear weapons?
Well, as a matter of fact, Congress has, in 2018, provided something like $46 billion by now, or some such number, for Los Alamos to continue making plutonium pits. I mean, they're taking pits that are in storage right now in Pantex, which is in Texas, and kind of making sure that they can still work. Plutonium is a funny metal. It changes a lot, even within 5 minutes. And within 50 years, it may have changed quite a bit and may not be reliable. So they are just now building factories, if you can believe it, to create new pits that they're confident will work. And they're smaller and can fit in new warheads. But it's an important topic. This is a good thing this movie came out.
Well, there's something serendipitous about watching the fact that Oppenheimer had property, he and his brother had property in New Mexico well before Los Alamos was ever used in the Manhattan Project. He happened to know the land. He lived in New York City, correct? But he and his brother owned this property in very, very rural New Mexico.
That's right. Oppenheimer fell in love with it as a teenager. He had developed dysentery on a family vacation in Germany just before he was supposed to start his first year in college. And he was confined to his apartment in Manhattan and driving his mother crazy. So she said, hey, can't we find someone from your high school to take a few months or a year off and you can go out to New Mexico? And that's what he did. He rode horseback and explored the whole area and fell in love with the land. And he says in the movie, I just need physics in New Mexico and I'll be happy.
That was Cindy Kelly, founder and president of the Atomic Heritage Foundation. Hear more interviews from C-SPAN's Washington Journal program on our website, cspan.org, on the C-SPAN Now app, or on C-SPAN Television, live every morning from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern.